From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Rock Around the Block, Timothy Rybak has written a history of rock music in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. He says rock has provided the soundtrack for perestroika and the democracy movements. Also, San Francisco City Archivist discovers a cover-up in the official history of the 1906 earthquake. Rock critic Ken Tucker examines country music's new traditionalism. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Glory, the new movie about a black army regiment during the Civil War. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega told a federal judge in Miami today that he's a political prisoner and refused to enter a plea on drug trafficking charges. The judge then entered an innocent plea for Noriega. At his arraignment today, Noriega argued through an attorney that he had been told Wednesday that protection would be withdrawn as crowds surrounded the Vatican embassy in Panama City. He said Noriega surrendered to avoid further bloodshed. However, the Archbishop of Panama said the surrender followed Noriega's realization that he had lost all support. In Washington, the Bush administration says the Vatican embassy had been planning to order Noriega to leave today. Details from NPR's Jim Engel.
A senior administration official explained to reporters what may have been the chief motivation for Noriega's surrender to U.S. authorities. He said the papal nuncio told Noriega his refuge in the Vatican embassy would expire today at noon, meaning the official said that he would no longer be a welcome guest. President Bush called Pope John Paul II this morning to thank him for the Vatican's role in the affair and to assure him that Noriega can and will get a fair trial in the United States. White House officials believe the turning point came over the weekend when Panamanian bishops wrote the Pope and argued that Noriega should be turned over to civilian authorities. The Vatican then wrote back saying it considered Noriega not in asylum, but rather in refuge from criminal charges. Noriega was apparently convinced that he had only two options for leaving the embassy, and he chose the United States over Panama. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
Drug Enforcement Administration today indicated Noriega would be returned to Panama to face charges there after his trial in the U.S. Officials of Panama's new government have said they plan to charge Noriega with murder in the deaths of officers who led the failed October coup. A leading member of the National Salvation Front declared the Communist Party in Romania dead today at a news conference called to give more details on planned April elections. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The National Salvation Front, Romania's provisional government, will run candidates in the April elections, according to Silvia Brucan. In a news conference tonight, Brucan said the front was not a political party, but rather a product of the revolution. There are about a half a dozen new parties that have formed in the past week, but organization is difficult in a country where all typewriters were registered until 2 weeks ago, telephones don't work, and the National Front has control over radio and television. Some leaders of the new parties want the elections postponed. They say April is too early for a real democratic contest. Today, the National Front held its first session with front leaders from all 40 counties in Romania. In Bucharest, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 13 points to close at 2796.08. Declines led advances 3-2 on volume of 177 million shares. This is NPR News. A school boycott by black students in Selma, Alabama, is being temporarily called off as attorneys file a federal lawsuit. Debbie Elliott of member station WUAL has details.
The student boycott is part of a protest of the white-controlled school board's decision not to renew the contract of Selma's first black school superintendent. State Senator Hank Sanders, a protest organizer, says the student boycott will temporarily end today because exams are coming up. Meanwhile, Sanders says protesters are filing a federal lawsuit challenging the 1977 law that created the city's appointed school board. Sanders, an attorney, says the law was never pre-cleared by the U.S. Justice Department as required under federal voting rights laws. Sanders says the student boycott will resume January 16th, the day after the Martin Luther King birthday holiday. For National Public Radio, this is Debbie Elliott reporting.
The Centers for Disease Control said today salmonella cases in New England and the Mid-Atlantic states have increased dramatically since 1979 and are far above the rate for other areas of the country. The health agency said that in 1982 and again in 87, 9 out of every 100,000 people living in New England states contracted salmonella during the course of the year. That compares with 1 or 2 cases per 100,000 in the rest of the nation. The CDC noted that raw or partially cooked eggs were implicated in 65 of 140 documented cases nationwide between 1985 and 1988. East Germany today turned part of the Berlin Wall into a Western-style billboard. Armed guards, who once kept strict eye to ensure nobody got near the wall, watched silently as the London-based advertising agency Saatchi & Saatchi pasted a huge poster behind the Brandenburg Gate on the eastern side. The slogan read, "Saatchi & Saatchi, first over the wall." I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Timothy Ryback, author of the new book, Rock Around the Block, A History of Rock Music in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union.
Rock and roll!
It's a 1978 recording of the Romanian rock band Iris. Since the end of World War II, Soviet bloc governments have condemned Western youth culture as a form of spiritual poison. Governments tried to eradicate rock and roll. Some musicians were even sent to prison, but rock music continued to be played. Many Americans are aware of the role that dissident writers have played in the democracy movements in Eastern Europe. In fact, writer Václav Havel is the new president of Czechoslovakia. I asked Timothy Ryback about the importance of rock music in Eastern Europe's current move towards democracy.
I think probably the best way to begin this was with a quote from a prominent Soviet who in May of 1987 condemned rock and roll music as a form of ideological AIDS. And he lamented at this time, saying that unfortunately we have no cure for this at this time. I think this AIDS metaphor is very good because in the course of the past 30 years, rock and roll has contributed significantly to the destruction of what you might call the ideological immune system in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. A year and a half ago, in 1988, you saw a complete collapse of official resistance to rock and roll music in virtually every East European country. This has been followed a year and a half later in the past 2 or 3 months. Has been played out, what was played out in the ideological sphere has now played itself out in the political realm. And although you cannot, you know, say rock and roll music is responsible for the collapse of communism, the Soviets themselves admit that rock and roll has significantly undermined the ideological commitment of young people. And I would argue that it's almost invested them with a sense of civil disobedience. Rock and roll, it's a rebellious type of music. It's a liberating type of music. And people have, there was a wonderful editorial in the New York Times earlier this week by a man from the Center for Security Studies. And he's used this phrase, in Eastern Europe, it's Leninism, not Leninism. And I think you have throughout all of Eastern Europe this abandoning of ideological commitment and its displacement by rock and roll and rock culture. I argue in the book that rock and roll music is unquestionably the most pervasive form of mass culture from what used to be the cusp of the Berlin Wall to the dockyards of Vladivostok.
There's really been a long history of banned music in Eastern Europe. Jazz was banned under the Nazis because it was black music and because they thought it sounded Jewishly gloomy. Then jazz was banned under Stalin. Stalin died in 1953, just in time for rock and roll. Was there always an anti-rock and roll policy in the Soviet bloc?
And the Soviets objected, or I guess the communist ideologists objected to rock and roll on three levels. You know, the first was the aesthetic, the second was the moral, and the third was ideological. And in these first two accounts, there isn't really a great deal of difference between the polemics that were hurled against rock and roll in the United States at that time and in the Soviet Union. There's a wonderful comparison. In March of 1957, the Catholic Church in America banned rock and roll from their schools, condemning it for its tribal rhythms and brutality. 1 month later, Dmitry Shepalov, who was the former Soviet minister, a foreign minister, denounced rock and roll as, quote, an explosion of the basest instincts and sexual urges. And so, you know, in one sense, the objection to rock and roll was virtually identical to the objections to rock and roll in the West. However, in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe, the ideological element came into play as well. And they saw this as a form of ideological subversion. Probably the most explicit example was following Elvis Presley's induction into the military in March of 1958. Suddenly in the Soviet media, you saw all of these condemnations of NATO as employing rock and roll music in its war against the Soviet bloc, the socialist community. This accusation, in fact, has some basis. I have a NATO document from November of 1958 that calls explicitly for the use of rock music in subverting the youth of the Soviet bloc. So it was used very consciously in the ideological war at that time.
Well, Elvis was inducted into the Army in 1958, and that's the same year that the recording we're about to hear was made. And this is the earliest Eastern European rock recording that you have in your collection. It's called Mr. Rock and Mr. Roll. Tell us a little bit about the song and who wrote it and performs it.
It was written, the lyrics and music were written by a songwriting team named Suchi and Schlitter. The song, as you mentioned, was written in 1958, is, as far as I've been able to determine, the earliest, not only the earliest recording, but the earliest example of an original rock and roll tune coming out of Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union. The song begins by, the lyrics are, "We don't know who they are, we don't know where they come from, Mr. Rock and Mr. Roll, but wherever they go, chairs are broken and windows are smashed." Then it goes in and chronicles all of this destruction that takes place in these concert halls and ends with the phrase, "Mujayem, Mujayem, who's to blame, who's to blame, Mr. Rock, Mr. Roll, Mujayem, Mujayem, Mr. Rock and Mr. Roll."
Well, let's listen to it, recorded in 1958 in Prague.
Nikdo neví, kdo to je, Mr. Rock a Mr. Roll, nedají nám pokoje, Mr. Rock a Mr. Roll, všude ty dva zvou, a tam, kde ti dva jsou, a tam se ničí, jen co vyčí, vše, co padne do rukou, když pak za čas vychladnou, mozky, mozky, ze stolů a židlí jsou trosky, trosky. A hned se začne řešit, kdo to bude platit, a budete se divit, ale nikdo nechce s tím nic mít.
Timothy Ryback is my guest, and he's the author of the new book Rock Around the Block, A History of Rock Music in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Can you describe some of the different techniques governments used over the years in their war against rock and roll?
They have employed just about every means at their disposal in an attempt to combat rock and roll music. The first attempts came in the late 1950s with the introduction of what were called 60-40 clauses, which required that 60% of any music performed publicly or in any music hall or restaurant be of socialist origin. The other 40% could come from the West as long as it was permitted by the censors. Well, what you found happening was that whenever someone from the government or from some agency were present, they would adhere to these 60-40 clauses, but as soon as they were gone, you know, they would just pick up and start playing rock and roll tunes. And a lot of times it was very typical that after midnight, they would sort of abandon all forms of socialist music and just, you know, let loose with the latest hits from the West, be it, you know, Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock or the latest Buddy Holly or Elvis Presley hit. The other techniques that they employed were somewhat more brutal. You had the use, for example, in November of 1965, East Germany's most popular rock band was disbanded on charges of tax evasion because they weren't allowed to play officially. They were holding concerts and charging people, but they were subsequently collecting revenues. But because this was quote unquote an illegal activity, they were not paying taxes, and the government eventually caught them on tax evasion charges and disbanded them. The young people of Leipzig estimated that between 1 and 2,000 people assembled in November of that year in central Leipzig demanding that the government rescind its ban, the city government rescind its ban on this group. The government sent in water cannons, attack dogs, and this rock riot and subsequent, you know, brutal suppression has been chronicled by numerous people. Once again, as far as I've been able to determine, this is the earliest example of a rock and roll riot in all of Eastern Europe.
Let's take a break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Timothy Ryback, author of the new book Rock Around the Block, A History of Rock Music in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Timothy Ryback is my guest. His new book is Rock Around the Block. I think it's fair to say that throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, there's been this kind of split in rock music in the Eastern Bloc countries between the officially sanctioned bands and the underground bands. I want to play a comparison of each, and this is from 1972. There are two bands from East Germany. Do you want to tell us their names and what these two bands represent in that split between official and underground?
Okay, when Erich Honecker came to power in 1971, his predecessor was a man named Walter Ulbricht, who was a real heavy-handed Stalinist-type leader. And Honecker introduced a liberalization in East Germany, relatively speaking, in which some concessions were made to the young people on the rock scene. The premier state band that emerged from this form of state cultural engineering was a group called the Pudies, which played a very clean, slick, Western-styled music. You hear tones of the Kinks and the Beatles in their songs. At the same time, however, because they became official, a lot of young people rejected this band, and their counterpart was a group called Rempft from the industrial city of Leipzig, and it was a much more hands-on, gutsy type of rock and roll. And you had in the early 70s rock fans who were either, you know, in favor of the Pudies or in favor of Rempft, and they basically played out this classic battle between, you know, the good boys of rock and roll who were the Beatles and the bad boys who were the Rolling Stones. And the two songs that we have, the two examples that I have here, one is from the first rock and roll recording ever released in East Germany. It's this the Pudies album. The other is an underground, an unofficial recording of a live Rempft concert made in Leipzig in 1972, basically at the same time.
So it's first the Pudies and then Rempft.
And then Rempft, yes.
Here we go. ¶¶ East German bands recorded in 1972, and my guest is Timothy Rybak, author of the new book Rock Around the Block, A History of Rock Music in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. It seems that there have been countries off and on in the Eastern Bloc who've tried to allow rock because they thought it would be a good release valve for the tensions of youth, but that kind of thing never seemed to last too long.
The best example for the attempt to co-opt rock music or use it as a social pressure valve was in Poland in 1981 after martial law was instituted. They sensed a great deal of frustration and antagonism from the youth. What they did was to, while they were oppressing Solidarity, oppressing underground publications, they simply took the lid off the rock scene, with an attempt to allow a vent for youth frustration. The whole thing exploded in their faces because suddenly you found in Poland hundreds and hundreds of upstart punk rock bands with, and the names themselves, I think, reflect the tenor of the times. You know, Sewage, Plutonium Death, Pathology of Pregnancy. One group was called SS-20, you know, a somewhat provocative name. It was based on the Soviet short-range nuclear missile. The government refused to print posters for this band, so they changed their name to Deserter, but used to appear in front of audiences shredding the party paper, screaming propaganda, and throwing it into the audiences, who, you know, naturally went absolutely wild.
We have a record here by Deserter, and the record is called Gray Reality. Would you introduce it to us for us?
Okay. This song is called Gray Reality. It begins with a somewhat Hendrix-like variation, guitar solo on a classic Tchaikovsky theme, once again an affront to official culture. And then it's followed by the song Gray Reality, which is sort of, you know, get the hell out of here, get away from me, I don't care about anything, you know, I don't give a damn about anything.
Okay, this is the Polish punk band Deserter. My guest is Timothy Rybak, author of the new book Rock Around the Block, A History of Rock Music in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Now that several countries in Eastern Europe have new governments and more freedom than they did before, what do you think the change is going to be in the rock music scene? So many of the bands had this anti-government identity. Will they have to change their music or change their identity to still have the same meaning that they had before?
The events of the last 2 months have really put the entire rock scene in an incredible state of crisis in Eastern Europe. A lot of the bands have simply dissolved because they were based on the whole idea of being in opposition to the state. And you found also that now that people are able to express themselves politically by other means, be it in the press, be it through demonstrations, a certain amount of energy has been taken out of the rock scene. And it is very much in a state of crisis. It will be interesting to see how it proceeds from here. The Soviet Union is a completely other animal. Of all of the East European countries, with the exception of Romania, they were the most oppressive in their attitudes toward rock and roll culture. Consequently, an official rock culture never developed there, which means that there are no institutions for dealing with rock music. And I was recently at a conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where they brought Soviet music industry people together with music industry officials from the West, or officials, what am I saying, music industry people from the West, to try to figure out ways of developing a proper rock culture there. What has happened is the rock culture has basically become like the Wild West was in the 1840s in this country, because rock bands no longer have, are no longer unofficial, but there are no official organs for dealing with them, meaning the whole idea of record contracts, the whole idea of a group being contracted to a manager. And you have bands now where a manager will own a band and another manager will try to buy that band away. What the other manager will do who's been slighted, he will send thugs out to break the legs of the other manager. There was a recent account in which a band was about to go on tour and a former manager of the group simply kidnapped the lead singer and kept him locked away for a week. And so the rock scene in the Soviet Union at this point is completely out of control.
I want to go out with something by the East German group Pankow, who you call one of the best groups in the Soviet bloc. Just tell us a few words about them.
Okay. Pankow is unquestionably the greatest rock and roll band in all of Eastern Europe. They are politically provocative, they are musically innovative, and their stage presence is absolutely brilliant.
Timothy, thanks a lot for talking with us. Timothy Rybak's book, Rock Around the Block, is published by Oxford University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and this is Pankow.
Alle Lichter gehen auf. Alle Fernseher gehen aus. Gut Nacht. Alle Seelen gehen aus. Gut Nacht. Auch das Licht im Treppenhaus. Geht aus.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Gladys Hansen had spent 25 years researching San Francisco's 1906 earthquake when her office shook in the quake of 89. Coming up, she reveals information about the destruction in 1906 that was suppressed, and she tells us about her ongoing work to document the quake of 89. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker takes a look at country's new traditionalism, and he reviews new albums from two of its leading proponents, Randy Travis and Rodney Crowell. And there's another new war movie. It's called Glory, but this one's not about Vietnam. It's about the Civil War. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. This afternoon in Miami, a judge entered a plea of not guilty on behalf of Manuel Noriega after the ousted Panamanian leader refused to recognize that a U.S. court is able to try him on drug charges. Noriega remains in custody without bail after turning himself over to U.S. officials last night in Panama City. Today on Capitol Hill, the reaction to the surrender of Noriega has been positive. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Democrats and Republicans alike hailed the capture of Noriega and the prospect that he will stand trial in a U.S. courtroom. There was even less criticism of the U.S. invasion today than there was in the days after U.S. troops landed in Panama City. Several lawmakers did express concerns about the future, however. Most are eager for U.S. troops to leave Panama as soon as possible and for the Endara government to establish its own legitimacy in the eyes of the Panamanian people. Democrat Chris Dodd of Connecticut said he was concerned that the U.S. not foster a situation in Panama that would lead to the emergence of another Noriega. The best way to prevent that, Dodd said, is to make sure the Panamanian Defense Forces, the PDF, are not reconstituted. Leaving Panama in a situation like Costa Rica with a police force but not a standing army would be the best solution, Dodd said. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A senior Bush administration official said today the Vatican Embassy in Panama City had been planning to order Noriega to leave at noon today if he had not surrendered. The Soviet Union today said that it will not recognize any trial in the U.S. of ousted Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega. Soviet officials once again argued that the U.S. was in violation of international law when it invaded Panama. The Environmental Protection Agency announced today that it's proposing new rules to limit gasoline vapors that escape from cars and trucks. The agency says the move will cut down greatly on a key component of smog. NPR's Michael Scholer has more.
A lot of the pollution that comes out of a car doesn't come out of the tailpipe. When a car is parked on a hot day, gas in the fuel tank heats and evaporates, and a vent lets the vapor into the air to release pressure. When cars are running, they also lose a lot of gas through evaporation, and this vapor contains hydrocarbons, a major ingredient of city smog. The EPA's new rules will make cars and trucks store more of the vapor than now required. The small cost of the added storage equipment should more than pay for itself in gas savings. The rules won't take effect for months, but the EPA says they could eventually cut hydrocarbon emissions nationwide by 5%, a big dent, though the most smog-ridden cities in the U.S. need at least a 50% drop in order to meet clean air standards. This is Michael Scholer in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 13.5 points in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Today, rock critic Ken Tucker goes country. He has a review of three new releases from Rodney Crowell, the Jayhawks, and this popular guy, Randy Travis.
It takes all kinds to keep this world in place. It's a fragile balance that lets us swing through space. So everybody's got their job to do. And girl, I guess the job I got is crying over you, and I should get a gold watch.
To look at the country music record charts, you'd have to conclude that the so-called new traditionalism has taken over. Most of the popular young performers today harken back to the country music of the 50s and early 60s, when the music featured pedal steel guitars, not synthesizers, and the singers phrased with a twang, not the anonymous inflections of TV anchor people. The undisputed king of the new traditionalism right now, as he has been for the past 3 years, is Randy Travis.
I've searched the world over all of my life, just looking for something to make my love shine like a candle that burns in the night. But I came up with nothing till I looked in your eyes, deeper and deeper inside. And all of the treasures I found in your soul was like finding a diamond when you're mining for coal.
Randy Travis's new album is called No Holding Back, which I interpret ironically because Travis's appeal is based on holding back. He's perfected a highly stylized restraint in which his lockjaw singing and murmured volume imply great emotions held in check. The unstated message is that if this big, tough, sad-eyed guy ever really spoke what was in his heart, he and it would burst.
Someday, someway, you'll realize that you've been blind. yes, darling, you're gonna need me again. It's just a matter of time. Go home, go home. Till you've reached the end of the line. Cause I know you'll pass my way again. It's just a matter of time.
In contrast to Randy Travis's mannerly machismo, there's the more forthright emotionalism of Rodney Crowell. Crowell's new album, Keys to the Highway, is a crucial one for his career. Crowell spent most of the 80s putting out well-crafted but ultimately dull country rock albums. They were the sort of records that suggested indecision and aesthetic doubt. Then last year, he released Diamonds and Dirt, a much more pure country record, and he suddenly became a star with no less than 5 number one hit singles in a row. As the follow-up to the biggest album of his career, this new Keys to the Highway has to prove that Crowell is no commercial fluke.
Travel lightly in my heart. You and I will never part. And far beyond this world we see, there's a place for you and me. And I thank my lucky star, we had a chance to heal our scars. Now I don't have to hang my head over things I wish I'd said.
Crowell is married to Roseanne Cash, a bigger star and a more consistent hitmaker, as well as being the daughter of Johnny Cash. Rodney Crowell is thus rooted in the music through both his family ties and his 20-year career as a Nashville songwriter and producer. Not rooted in the music at all are the Jayhawks, a quartet from Minneapolis. The Jayhawks are led by lead singer and songwriter Mark Olson, and they approach country from a generation once removed. They don't emulate Merle Haggard, they emulate rocker Gram Parsons, who emulated Merle Haggard. In other musicians, this sort of thing can lead to cheap self-consciousness and an arty falseness. But Mark Olson has the ability to back up his passion with original melodies and vivid lyrics. Don't expect to hear the Jayhawks' style of country rock on the same country radio stations that revere Randy Travis, but a song such as Dead End Angel is as strong as contemporary country music gets.
Go to sleep, my dead end angel. Say goodnight.
We're listening to the Jayhawks from their new album, Blue Earth. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Village Voice, LA Weekly, and Spin. This is Fresh Air. When the earthquake hit San Francisco in 1989, Gladys Hansen was wrapping up a 25-year project investigating the devastating effects of the 1906 quake. Hansen is the archivist for the city of San Francisco. Her new book, Denial of Disaster, reveals that a lot of information about the 1906 quake was suppressed. I asked her what tipped her off that there was a cover-up going on.
My first clue was a study that I began about 25 years ago, and that was to find out how many people actually died in 1906. And so since about 1965, I've been slowly working through the records and so forth, and finally producing a figure now that we are very proud of. Not proud that so many died in 1906, but proud that 80 years have elapsed and we were able to do this kind of work. We're up to over 3,000 people. Now, this is rather interesting because the city of San Francisco, through our board of supervisors in 1907, said that only 478 people died. General Greely, the U.S. Army, came out and said, no, 498 people died. And then the state of California said, okay, we're going to do it a little bit better. 503 died.
I'm interested in the rewriting of history that you found. You found that one of the people who helped rewrite history was a public relations agent of the Southern Pacific Railroad Company.
That's right.
And that he wanted to rewrite history a little bit to diminish the impact of the quake so as not to discourage Easterners from investing in California enterprise. What are some of the things that he did to play down the effects of the quake?
He was, of course, paid by Southern Pacific Company, and they were the largest, industry here in California, private industry. And so they hired the best writers in the state and had them write all the stories about this earthquake. They, of course, were aware that unless San Francisco recovered and recovered quickly, Eastern money wasn't going to be brought back into the city. In other words, in order for the city to recover, we had to totally brag that we had a fire. Let's talk fire, certainly not earthquake, because it's bad for business.
You found that the realtors in San Francisco took a vote, and they passed a resolution to call 1906 the Great Fire instead of the Great Quake, because they, too, were concerned that real estate value would go down if people thought that this was an earthquake, that this was earthquake damage and that there was the possibility of another quake. Did that stick at all? I mean, did realtors or other people take to calling the 1906 disaster the Great Fire instead of the Great Quake?
Oh, yes. Even today you'll read stories that writers, and modern-day writers, where they relate to our 1906 episode as the Great Fire, not as the Great Earthquake at all. This is really sad, mainly because you expect more of people that are researching to get into the actual materials like we have done.
Do you think that any of the subsequent building codes or earthquake preparedness programs have been based on the misinformation that you've been discovering?
Very definitely. We've been concerned because, the FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Program there, they have gauged all their, deaths in it. In other words, they have put together a very large volume, and in it tells you exactly what to expect from a large earthquake, like 8.25. They're still using the figure of 487 dying in San Francisco, and now we know we have 3,000. Well, that's changing figures. Everything has to change as these studies come in now because they're no longer applicable. We've got many more people dying, many more people injured. So this means all this study has to be rewritten, and they have to start understanding what truly is going to happen.
What flashed through your mind during the quake just a few months ago? What were your very first thoughts?
I had just gotten off the telephone, and the building started to become noisy, and then the air filled with, was like almost smoke, but it was all the dust and so forth falling from the ceilings and so forth, and I didn't believe it. I was mostly concerned about my staff. Right away, I started looking around to see where the staff was, and they had sought spots in doorways. And then I saw one gal that was standing alone, and she was from Minnesota, and I she didn't like earthquakes, so I raced to her to be with her. And then we rode it out together, watched glass tumble from our frame pieces on the walls and a stained glass window that was hanging fall and so forth. I think the part I didn't like was the noise. It was scary in that you felt that the building was coming apart.
It's a very bizarre situation, really. Here you are, you've been spending about 20 years of your life researching the quake of 1906, and just as your book is on the verge of being published, there's another quake, and a rather large one. What this does is, in a way, give you an opportunity to collect information correctly this time around. What have you been doing to document the effects of the 1989 earthquake?
Well, I was truly trained in 1906. I've been through that earthquake, at least I feel I have, and I realized immediately the importance of firsthand accounts, people that would write their story within a day or two or a week, even a month, because we would be then reaching the people that had gone through this, and it was their words. They weren't being intimidated by outside press, television, and so forth. It was their stories that they were giving us. And they started coming in. Do you know we've got over 700 stories have come in? And that's only adult stories. It doesn't include the children. But the nice thing about this, many people have written, not only giving them wonderful, wonderful stories, but they have thanked us. They've actually said, we thank you for asking us to do this because we were really uptight about this earthquake. And by writing it down, putting it in an envelope, sealing it, mailing it off to you, we are now ready to live again. So it was cheaper than going to a psychiatrist.
Your new book is about how people tried to deny the earthquake disaster of 1906 and talk about it being a fire, underplay the casualties. Do you think there's any denial happening in the earthquake of 89?
It's much more difficult to deny now because everyone's watching. But there is a denial. There is a denial that the earthquake wasn't as severe as it was. San Francisco experienced a lot of damage, and damage to places that were not noted other than the marina. Marina received all the attention, and the freeway, the bridge, and so forth. But we had damage south of Market, many instances, places that were damaged in the 1857, our early earthquakes. The same buildings went down. We had damage out in the Richmond District. We had damage in the Sunset District. Large areas, there were just pockets, but there was lots of damage. And those are the people that I feel sorry for because it's like they were forgotten.
Well, now a lot of people are worrying what the real big one is going to be like. There's a chapter in your book written by the former fire chief of San Francisco who collaborated with you on this book.
Yes.
And he expresses his concern that fires today would be even worse than they were in 1906. What are some of the reasons why he's predicting that?
Well, you have to remember in 1906 we had a city half the size that we have today, population of 450,000 in 1906 against, say, 800 today. The city is building to building now. There is no open space except for the parks and the Presidio and so forth. And he's very concerned that the western part of the city, fires would start there because he classed these buildings. There are no firewalls between them. And in other words, one block, I believe, would be 28 buildings, and that would be basically one, and to a fireman, it'd be one building that would go, would it be a very large fire, and that would be one block that would be gone. But those westerly winds would bring that fire and drive it right through the city. He's really concerned, and of course, he's concerned about the high-rises. We're concerned that perhaps the buildings might survive, but will the people in them survive, especially with all the different synthetics that we have today and plastics, that as soon as fires hit them, smoke takes you out, toxic, and so you're in trouble.
Are you doing anything now to prepare for the big one?
You mean the city or me?
I mean you personally.
Me personally? Yes. You know, I live out by Lake Merced, and we have gone through and we've added all the supports to the house that is needed. We have a large supply of water. We have extra food. We have flashlights. We have rosary beads saying, please, let's not have it again.
Gladys Hansen is the archivist for the City of San Francisco and the co-author of Denial of Disaster. It's published by Cameron and Company of San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Robert, what stories do you have on General Noriega?
Well, we'll be reporting both from Florida, where Noriega is in custody, and also from Panama, now that the former head of the Panamanian military has surrendered to U.S. officials and is going to stand trial here. We'll also be hearing about a murder case in Boston, which took a bizarre twist yesterday. A man who had told police that his pregnant wife was shot and killed by a robber, as they sat in the car together, then became a suspect in the very crime and committed suicide yesterday. And we'll also be hearing about the cartoon studio that made such cartoons as those with Mr. Magoo and Gerald McBoing-Boing.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the past few years, there's been an abundance of movies about the Vietnam War, but Glory is a new film about a regiment in the Civil War. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
A lot of the credit for what's good about Glory ought to go to its source, not the producer Freddie Fields, as many reviewers have claimed, but someone far more intriguing, Lincoln Kirstein, the founder and longtime director of America's finest dance company, New York City Ballet. Kirstein is, among many other things, a Civil War buff, and the author of a book called Lay This Laurel, about the 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry. The 54th was a black regiment in the Union Army, and it was led by the young white Boston Brahmin, Robert Gould Shaw. The story of Shaw's regiment has long been regarded as among the most heroic chapters in the history of the Civil War. Shaw trained his men long and hard, refused to allow them to be used merely as labor behind the front lines, and finally died along with half his men at the unsuccessful assault on Fort Wagner in 1863. Kirstein asked his friend, the young screenwriter Kevin Jarre, to whip together a script about Shaw and the 54th for director James Ivory. Jarre's major previous film credit was the original script for, of all things, Rambo. But by all accounts, he did a smashing job on Glory. 5 years later, however, under the direction of Edward Zwick, the co-creator of 30-something, the result is a good deal less smashing. Glory is stiff and old-fashioned and cliched, and also occasionally moving. Everyone in it is so terribly, terribly noble that even the most predictable scenes can make the heart involuntarily swell, like this one.
You men enlisted in this regiment on the understanding that you would be paid the regular army wage of $13 a month. This morning I have been notified that since you are a colored regiment, you will be paid $10 a month.
Yeah, Uncle Abe got himself a real bargain here.
That's right. Tear it up. If you men will take no pay, then none of us will.
That's Matthew Broderick as Colonel Shaw, a piece of miscasting that nearly ruins the movie. Broderick is more stilted and uncomfortable here than I've ever seen him, and his accent lists foggily between stage Southern and stage Shakespearean. In any case, it sounds all wrong on a purported Boston boy. The regiment he commands is a collection of stereotypes from a bomber squad movie. There's the religious one who turns out to be a crack shot, the rebellious one who learns to be the bravest of them all, the elderly sage who keeps the boys in line, and finally the wimpy intellectual who gradually gets toughened up. All of them are well played, especially by Denzel Washington as the rebel and Morgan Freeman as the sage, but they never quite come to seem anything other than what they really are, stock figures meant to personalize the regiment and give us some stake in their drama. Director Zwick does well by the battle scenes. They're realistic and harrowing and scary, and they amply demonstrate the futility and meaninglessness of battle. But in between, the movie contradicts them, orating and pontificating about the worthiness of the cause these poor soldiers are about to die for. As the James Horner score trumpets and soars, you feel oddly displaced, as though you were watching one of those World War II movies made to keep American fighting spirit aflame. Glory is a film out of time. It seems to be aimed at a world that never lived through Vietnam and the atomic age, a world that never questioned the value and efficacy of war.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Dan Lachlan, Richard Parker, and Scott Williams. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet actor and comic Rick Aviles. He got his start doing stand-up on New York City streets and in the subways. He co-stars in Jim Jarmusch's new film, Mystery Train. Also, poet Robert Haas reads from his new book, Human Wishes. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.